and a good Tuesday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook. Don't forget that you can take the show with you 24/7 on demand by checking out the Nick Craig Show, available in your favorite podcast app. You can also visit the website and listen online at nickcraig.com. Our show this morning is brought to you in part by The Law Group. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com or give them a call at 910-251-6088. More from them coming up a little bit later on in the program this morning. Well, it is slated to be a busy week in government. Not that things, I guess, as we've been covering over the last couple of weeks, not that things have necessarily been slow, but since around the July 4th holiday, Congress has been out of session. They, of course, the big, beautiful bill signed in on July 4th. But we, last time we were covering really what was going on in Congress was the week before that, leading up to that, the debate taking place on the big, beautiful bill in both the Senate and the House, President Trump signing it into law on July the 4th. And since then, Congress, for the most part, has been on recess. There's been some skeleton sessions here and there, some things being discussed. But in terms of all the delegation folks from all across the United States being in Washington, D.C., well, that has not been the case. However, as we look forward to what is coming up on your second day of September, as we ring in the new month, both chambers, the House and the Senate in Washington, D.C., are set to return from their various districts across the United States. And one of the big things that you are going to hear discussed over the next couple of weeks is going to be government funding. As it stands right now, funding is scheduled to run out as it stands on September the 30th. This is under a stopgap spending bill that was approved by Congress in March of this year to continue. There was set to be a government shutdown in March to continue funding, to allow government to continue in its operation. Lawmakers passed that stopgap funding measure to fund the government until the end of September. And, you know, as we see every single time, just kicking the can down the road, extending it a couple of months here or there, all of that to lay out what is likely to be a busy month in Congress. Couple of other things that, of course, we'll get into, but government funding is probably set to be the largest in terms of actual importance in terms of having an impact on everything going on. Government funding will be the largest. There are other things, and we'll get into those and cover those in the coming weeks as we watch that unfold. But obviously, a government shutdown going to be a big topic of discussion. We'll see in terms of funding what lawmakers, obviously, as you know and are well aware of, Republicans do have complete and exclusive control of government in Washington, D.C. You've got President Trump laying down the law in the Oval Office, and then, of course, Republicans having their majorities in both the Senate and the House. It will be interesting to see, depending on what this spending bill looks like, how short term is it going to be? Is this going to be a long term bill? Are we going to kick the can down the road till around Christmas, which is typically what happens? They'll pass a stopgap funding measure until around the end of the year. So that will force lawmakers right around Christmas time to be in Washington, D.C. and saber rattling over government spending. So we'll see exactly what we do, what happens there. But for Republicans, especially those in the House, a lot of the question is going to be, can they get all Republicans on board? As you probably can imagine, and we don't have any of the details yet, I'm sure debate has gone on, you know, and this is kind of one of the things to note. We see this even in North Carolina as the General Assembly is on, you know, essentially a break or a recess. They've got a couple of voting days left. Big difference, I'll note. In North Carolina, the legislature is part-time, where in Congress, they are a full-time governing body. They do have breaks and recesses. When lawmakers are not in this case, Washington, D.C., or in Raleigh, you still have discussions that are taking place, especially when you get up to the senior levels of leadership. Like, for example, Mike Johnson's office, Speaker Johnson in the House, he's not just been off for the last month and a half playing golf and hanging out in Louisiana. I mean, he has been, him and his staff have been working with other members in House leadership. You can imagine across the chamber dealing with folks in the Senate leadership office. They've been working on this stuff behind the scenes, negotiating, hammering out details, and that will, of course, lay the bedrock, the groundwork for what we'll see in this spending bill. So as it stands right now, both chambers will need to pass, and President Donald Trump will have to sign a total of 12 funding bills to avert a complete or partial government shutdown by September the 30th. So far, the Senate has passed an initial draft of 3 of 3, while the House has only passed 2. Only one, a bill to fund military construction, has passed both chambers. Lawmakers will also need to pass the National Defense Authorization Act, which is an annual bill to set military policy. However, the toughest challenge for the spending bills will be the Senate, where Republicans will need support of 7 Democrats to overcome a filibuster. Despite that, the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, and the director there, in Russ Vaught, has called for a less bipartisan appropriation process. However, Senate Majority Leader John Thune, the Republican out of South Dakota, disagreed, telling reporters, quote, "It's going to take 60 votes to fund the government." So you've got some problems there. You've, of course, got Russ Vaught, who is the director of OMB, a Trump pick to lead that, which, you know, is not a surprise. It is the president's prerogative and directive to choose who leads OMB. Russ Vaught wants the president's agenda to be put in full play. He knows very well that Democrats are not going to cross the aisle and support anything that Republicans want to do. I mean, we live in a very hyper-partisan time in politics, and both parties are guilty of this. Now, I would probably argue, and some may disagree with me, and if so, I'd be curious on what your feedback is, but for the most part, both sides don't support pretty much anything that the other does. Now, I think if you were looking at the odds, Republicans are more likely to support something that Democrats do. When you look at spending bills, you look at some of the things that were passed in the final 2 years of the Biden administration when Republicans had control of the House, Democrats had control of the Senate, and of course the executive branch with Biden being the president, you saw Republicans more times than not standing with Democrats and just a few of them supporting Democrat initiatives and getting those things over the finish line. I would argue that Democrats are less likely to do that than Republicans, and especially now, right? When, let's look at the overall political temperature, the political atmosphere that exists in the United States. Right now, and we've talked about this over the last couple of months, the Democrat Party is struggling majorly with its base. When you look at polling numbers, when you look at approval numbers within the Democrat Party, they are at historic lows. And there are two reasons for that. One of those is that Republicans are just running rampant in Washington, D.C. They've got power of both houses of Congress and the executive branch. So for the most part, you've seen Donald Trump and conservatives and Republicans in Congress pretty much able to do whatever they damn well please. And while folks on the left may be frustrated and pissed off and upset about that, they won. And I mean, it's pretty simple. We had a major election back in November of last year. There were Republicans and Democrats on the ballot all over the United States. Trump had a massive win in the presidential election, not only the Electoral College, but the popular vote, very clearly showing the very clearly telegraphing that the ideas that were being played out by those on the political left were not popular with the vast majority of the American voters. You had Republicans retaining their majority in the United States House, albeit by a slim margin. But even one vote is more than enough to get your agenda passed And then, of course, flipping control in more votes than thought before, flipping control of the U.S. Senate from Democrat control to Republican control. A massive banner election cycle in 2024. Contrary to what the media might tell you, it was an overwhelming victory for Republicans. So when we look at why people are so pissed off with the Democrat Party, one is that the Democrat agenda is being hacked and slashed at lightning breakneck speed in Washington, D.C. And if you are a progressive Democrat and you are watching everything that you have fought for the last 4 years be completely dismantled in front of your very eyes, some things within the span of just days of Trump being in the Oval Office, in some cases, hours after he was sworn in as the 47th president of the United States, signing executive orders and completely blowing out the Democrat agenda, you're going to be pretty pissed off. You're not going to have a positive view on the Democrat Party that let all of your ideas, all of your principles be completely blown out in the span of days, hours, if not weeks or months, which is exactly what you've seen happen in Washington, D.C. So one of the reasons that the Democrat Party approval is so low is because everything that they support or a lot of their more progressive ideals are being completely shot up and just destroyed. So that's one reason why Democrat Party morale and approval is so low. The other is probably why you will not see Democrats cross the aisle. There is a large contingent of those on the progressive left side of the political aisle that feel that Democrat lawmakers are not doing enough. Now, the reality is very simple. Democrats are not in majority. They don't have a majority in either chamber. And as the party that is not in majority, there's very little that you can do, especially when you've got somebody like President Donald Trump steering the ship from the Oval Office. He is not a weak leader. You may not like him as a leader, but he's not a weak leader. He is not somebody that rolls over on things often. Now, when something is a bad idea, when something doesn't play out as previously anticipated, he'll pivot. He'll change his thought. He can adapt to things pretty quickly, but he's not going to be bullied into changing something because Democrats who are not in the majority are pissed off about something, right? That's not going to happen. It may happen with other presidents. It may happen even with other Republicans, but it's not going to happen with Donald Trump. So there is a movement on the progressive side of the political aisle. There's some thought on the progressive side of the political aisle that enough is not being done to stand up to Donald Trump, stand up to the Republicans, and push back against the so-called MAGA agenda. And so this puts Democrats in a very precarious spot. Obviously, the vast majority of the things that Trump is doing in Washington, D.C., Democrats will claim they're not in favor of. Some of that is because they are diametrically politically opposed to them. Democrats and liberals believe certain ways about certain things. Republicans and conservatives feel some, in most cases, the complete opposite way about those issues. So inherently, you've got political disagreements that exist between the two political parties. That's nothing new. That is why, part of the reason why the two-party system continues to be as prominent as it does in the United States. So yes, of course, you've got Democrats that vehemently disagree with what Trump's doing because they are diametrically opposed to the policies. But for things that Democrats might be able to agree with, for example, something like military spending, it is very hard for them to cross the aisle and vote with Republicans on anything because they risk becoming under fire from those in the progressive wing of the Democrat Party. Those on the progressive left do not want to give Republicans, or more importantly, Trump, wins on anything. If Trump were to proclaim from the Oval Office today that it is Tuesday, September the 2nd, you would have those on the political left that would be adamantly against that and would call their Democrat lawmakers and make sure that they did not support a measure in which the president said today is September the 2nd. just because they refuse to give Donald Trump any solace and any credit for anything. And that's fine. That's this is a political strategy that you are watching play out. This is nothing new. But when you look at things like, for example, we're talking about spending, which runs out on September the 30th of this month, it is going to be very hard, especially for any Democrat senators that are on the ballot coming up next year. It is going to be hard for them to work with Republicans at all. Now, it's obviously an issue in the Senate where you're dealing with a 6-year cycle. It is even more important in the House where that cycle is ever repeating. It is going to be very, very tough for especially those in swing districts, swing counties, swing states, for them to work across the aisle on anything. Because if they do, you will see the progressive wing of the party latch onto those candidates and claim these people need to be primary. These individuals are not standing up strong enough against the evil, awful, terrible MAGA agenda. So it puts Democrats in a very precarious spot. Now, interestingly to note, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, of course, from New York, and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, also from New York, have called for pursuing a, quote, bipartisan pathway on appropriations, which is very interesting. The progressive wing does not like this. Those on the far left side of the political aisle do not like Chuck Schumer or Hakeem Jeffries, who I would argue Jeffries is more of a progressive than Schumer. Now, I think Schumer obviously has a much longer political tenure. I think he probably knows the political game better than most in Washington, D.C. I don't like Chuck Schumer. I don't like his ideas. I don't like the things that he stands for, but he is a smart political operator. Chuck Schumer knows the game, knows how it's played, and knows how to traverse that game very well. And the progressive wing has caused him some heartache over the last couple of years because he understands the path to victory. Again, when you're in the minority, you don't get victories very often. And most of the time, it's not about getting what you want. It's about getting less of what you don't want. I'll say that again. When you're in the minority, and this is something that Republicans struggle with as well. We saw this under the Biden administration. You're never going to get what you want when you're in the minority. And so all you can really lobby for is getting less of what you don't want to be enacted. And yes, that is in fact a win. And I'll contend to even some of my conservative friends this morning, we need to come around to this concept and start believing in this idea a little bit better. When the other party has exclusive and complete power, even the smallest victories need to be applauded, right? You're not going to get sweeping reform to government like you might want it when your party is the minority in the House and the Senate and the Oval Office, which is what you had for the first 2 years during the Biden administration. Even in the last 2 years, you had just control of the House by, what was it, like 5 or 6 votes? I mean, your ability to negotiate, your bargaining chips are relatively small. And so simply advocating for your policies and your ideals really doesn't do any good because nothing's going to get approved. But if you can push off or hold off some of the other party's priorities, if you can try and fight off some of the things that you are opposed to as the opposite political party, that is a major win. And so I'm curious, as Schumer and Jeffries make these comments and told the media this over the last couple of weeks, that they were interested in a bipartisan path, it's going to be interesting to see what they mean by that. What does a bipartisan path look like from the eyes of more predominantly Chuck Schumer, who is holding up the vote and will be able to hold up the vote in the Senate under the 60-vote filibuster? It's going to be very interesting what bipartisan path looks like to him. It really, if I'm being perfectly honest with you, doesn't really matter what Hakeem Jeffries wants. Speaker Mike Johnson doesn't need any Democrats to support him in the House. That's, of course, under the thought that all Republicans are on board. We've already seen issues with that this year. So who knows exactly what that might look like. And, you know, maybe do you have the, you know, the Thomas Massies of the world and some of the others that block Republican efforts to pass a budget or pass these 12 spending bills more accurately because he doesn't think the cuts go far enough or it's not exactly what he wants. So he's ready to just burn the entire thing to the ground. So it's going to be curious as Republicans go through that. So that is obviously one of the biggest issues that have to be dealt with is this some sort of spending measure, 12 appropriation bills before September the 30th or the discussion of a government shutdown. When does that spending go in toward, go until? Not immediately clear on that. So that's one of the big things in Congress. The other is Trump nominations. And you've seen Trump battling with Thune over the last couple of weeks over this. There was some discussion about recessed appointments as the Senate was in recess over the last 6 weeks or so. And Senate Republicans this week, as they make their way back to Washington, will also continue their efforts to confirm Trump's executive appointees, which have been slowed by Democrat procedural moves. It's important to note that it does only take a simple majority to confirm those nominees in the United States Senate, which Republicans clearly have in the Senate. So there's no real risk there, as Senate rules make it a simple majority to confirm those nominees one by one. Unanimous consent where there is no objection from a senator allows a nominee to be confirmed without a roll call vote. Democrats have refused to provide such consent, running out their time for each nominee going forward. This has led some Senate Republican leaders, including Leader Thune, to contemplate changing the Senate rules in order to allow for nominees to be confirmed expeditiously. Thune saying last month, quote, "I think they're desperately in need of a change, speaking of the rules. I think that the last 6 months have demonstrated that this process of nominations is broken. And so I suspect there will be some good, robust conversation about that." Democrats over the last 6 months have further blocked nominations through refusal to return their blue slips. You've likely heard about that phrase in the news a little bit. A tradition that allows senators to approve or block a judicial or U.S. attorney nomination in their home state. Trump has challenged the process, saying back on August the 25th that blue slips make it impossible for him to appoint a judge or U.S. attorneys in any state where you've got one, if not two, senators that are of the Democrat Party. Trump has also challenged that process as well. Meanwhile, Senate Judiciary Chairman Chuck Grassley, the Republican from Iowa, has rejected Trump's request to do away with the blue slips. Grassley writing in a post on X back on August the 25th as well, writing in part, quote, "As a U.S. attorney, district judge nominees without a blue slip does not have the votes to get confirmed on the Senate floor. They don't have the votes to get out of the committee." So that is one of the interesting things as well that we will see play forward, as Democrats are, again, doing exactly what you would expect the party not in power to do, is to filibuster, no pun intended, to block and slow roll. And I will argue and I will make the point that I hope Republicans take this same approach next time that they are not in power. Right? We have seen that Democrats are unwilling to approve nominations. And you might say to yourself, well, Nick, you know, what's the issue here? This has got to be something that's pretty common. And, you know, it is to some extent. But overall, when you see a political party that is not in power, like the Democrats aren't right now, yes, you can fight over legislation. Yes, you can fight over funding. Yes, you can fight over this and fight over that. Nominations typically aren't something that you fight over tooth and nail. Why? Because the party, in this case, the president that is sitting in the Oval Office, has exclusive authority for nominating judges and making some of these political appointments, right? Those on the political left, or in this, in the case of parties in general, those not in power, you are need to be a rubber stamp for appointments. Now, we've seen Republicans, and I would argue at this point, unfortunately, roll over and allow those appointees from Democrats to go forward. It's been very frustrating to watch because we see what the other side does. And this comes back to a broader and greater argument that I think Republicans really need to take to heart. It is time to play the rule by the same game. I get the concept of the high road. I get that we don't want to drag ourselves down into the mud like the Democrats. I get all of that. But the reality is very simple. If Democrats refuse to appoint Trump's appointments for district, United States district attorney, so on and so forth, then next time, and it will happen sooner rather than later, the next time that Republicans are not in charge, they need to put up the same damn fight. I am sick of being the party of the so-called moral high ground when we watch Democrats block the agenda that Trump has got a relatively short time frame to get enacted. Midterm elections are almost a little more than a year away. This runway for the MAGA agenda, for Trump's agenda, is shortening every single hour over the next year. And especially as we get closer to the midterm elections, the late summer and fall of next year, you are going to find it much tougher for Trump to push forward some of his agenda items that might be more controversial. Because Republicans in swing districts, both in the Senate and in the House, are going to find it harder to support legislation that might be controversial. They are going to find it harder to support legislation that might cause them some political blowback. And so as Trump and as the administration continues to work through this stuff, the time is now. And if Chuck Grassley and John Thune want to allow this stuff to play out slowly, I'd say shame on them. We're in the driver's seat. I will remind you once again what happened in November of last year. Republicans had overwhelming majorities top to bottom from President Trump. Republicans were only supposed to have a 2 or 3 seat majority in the Senate. They have a 6-seat majority in the United States Senate, overwhelmingly exceeding expectations and continuing to hold control in the House. That does not happen by accident. That was not a fluke. That was not just 1 or 2 elections that went in favor of Republicans. That was not flipping a coin and getting lucky on election night and just winning some races. This happened as an overwhelming rejection of the Democrat Party and Democrat ideals. And it is so incredibly frustrating to watch Republicans allow Democrats to slow walk these processes, filibuster this process to the nth degree, and just block and slow down everything that the Trump administration is wanting to do. You don't have to love everything that Trump is doing. I don't, right? There's a big battle going on in tariffs right now. We'll dive into that later on this week, or we're looking forward to diving in on that later on this week, trying to get some guests booked to talk about that. So I don't love everything that Trump's doing. Tariffs is a great example, but he's in power. He is in control. And he has the ability and, of course, has the absolute authority to nominate individuals for judges or U.S. attorneys. He has that ability. He has that authority. And if Democrats want to ignore the process because they hate Donald Trump, if Democrats want to pass up what has been in the past years of saying, you know what? We don't love this person, but we're not in charge. We're going to let the president play out their agenda. If Democrats want to ignore that, then I look forward to Republicans doing the same thing next time. It is time to either change the rules or give Republicans a taste, Democrats a taste of their own medicine next time they're in power. No more rolling over. No more saying, oh, we got to follow precedent. Oh, well, shucks. We just got to follow through and come along to get along. To hell with that. I'm over it. And so that's a major thing that you are seeing right now that is absolutely stonewalling the Trump administration. Now, there's a couple of other things to keep in eye, keep in mind as the House and Senate reconvenes today to begin a busy month of September in Washington, D.C. One of those is the federalization of Washington, D.C. We'll get into those details plus some of your comments coming up here in just a few minutes. Before that, I do want to tell you and thank the Law Group for their continued support of the Nick Craig Show. When legal challenges arise, make sure you put your trust in the Law Group right here in Wilmington. Since 2003, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across the eastern half of our state. Whether you're facing a divorce, navigating real estate transactions, or God forbid you're in a situation where you need a strong defense, the Law Group has your back. Their dedicated team ensures your questions are answered and issues are resolved as quickly as possible. Great news, folks. They're located right here in Wilmington downtown and just a phone call away at 910-251-6088, or you can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. Give them a call, 910-251-6088, or their website, lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication you can rely on. We appreciate the Law Group and their continued support of the Nick Craig Show and encourage you for any legal challenges, big or small, reach out to the Law Group. Let them know that you heard about it here on the Nick Craig Show, lawgroupnc.com or 910-251-6088. Congress is going to have to deal with President Donald Trump's crackdown on crime in Washington, D.C. We'll get into some of those details coming up as the Nick Craig Show rolls on the day after the Labor Day holiday weekend, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, X, Facebook, and of course available 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. And a good Tuesday morning to you. Welcome back to the Nick Craig Show as we kick off the month of September. Taking a quick look at your forecast this morning. Today, temperatures in the lower middle 80s. No chance of any rain. Should be a real nice one. Cooler start to the day. Only 63 degrees out in Wilmington right now. Temperatures staying mild for the next couple of days before they heat up into this weekend. Temperatures close to 90 degrees Friday and Saturday. So far it looks to be a nice start to the month of September as we get kicked off here in this month. All right, so back to the Congress as lawmakers from all across the U.S., their various districts and states will be making their way back to Washington, D.C. starting today to begin hammering out a lot of business, a lot of the things that we've talked about over the last 6 or 8 weeks. Congress has not been in session, so a lot of things for them to deal with. One of the biggest, in terms of impact, it's obviously big for the District of Columbia and Washington, D.C., and could be relevant in some other large municipalities, but it's probably to get the most news coverage, and it's gotten an incredible amount of news coverage, is Trump's crackdown on crime in Washington, D.C. We saw the president back a couple of weeks ago use his authority, which he in fact does have to the chagrin of those on the left, his authority, usurping that authority on the District of Columbia and sending in federal authorities to crack down on crime. Sending in federal authorities to clean up the streets of Washington, D.C. From panhandling to tent cities to the homeless population, open air drug use, public intoxication, urination, defecation on the streets. Like many other paradise Democrat cities across the country, D.C. falling into the same trap as everybody else, allowing their progressive ideas, allowing their progressive policies to take what was once a prominent place that people wanted to visit into what I call progressive hellholes, which is what Washington, D.C. had unfortunately become. So President Donald Trump used his authority, which is limited in scope and based on time, to send in federal officials. And one of the major things that is going to be up for debate in Congress, and one thing that you are going to see major pushback from on the left, is going to be Congress extending Trump's authority to control the Washington Metropolitan Police Department. So here are the details. Under Section 740 of the House Rules Act of 1973, the president can take control of the local police force for up to 48 hours and can renew the authority for up to 30 days. And we are well within that 30-day period of time right now. after that 30-day mark, or to continue it after a 30-day mark, Congress would need to sign off on continued federalization. And so that is going to be a major discussion. The White House has continued to ratchet up the pressure on Congress, even though they haven't been there. As I mentioned earlier, discussions are happening behind the scenes. House and Senate leadership, they are continuing discussions. You can imagine that they're probably, I don't know if they're talking with Trump, maybe they are, but they're talking to high up officials, Stephen Miller and other folks within the White House, talking to those either individuals or their leadership staff, talking to them about how to go through this process. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt recently said that the administration will reevaluate and make further decisions after the 30-day period is up, saying, quote, during the 30 days, our entire focus is making sure that this is the most efficient operation possible and that we are removing as many criminals from the streets and cleaning up D.C. as best as we can. In another executive action on August the 11th, President Donald Trump ordered the deployment of the National Guard to the District of Columbia. Any move by Congress to extend Trump's authority would require the consent of at least 7 Democrats in the Senate, which is probably, again, going to be hard to come by, again, for multiple reasons. No Senate Democrat wants to become the target of the progressive movement that will claim that they are green-lighting, rubber-stamping, signing on to President Donald Trump's authoritarian takeover of the District of Columbia. Of course, I say that incredibly sarcastically because, you know, anytime President Donald Trump does anything, even this, which, again, very clearly is stated in Section 740 of the House Rules Act of 1973, the president has 30 days and has 30-day window to take control of the Metropolitan Police Department in D.C. There's no question about that. It's not a gray area where it's not really clear. No, it is very clear and very obvious that the president has this authority. He has acted on that authority. He continues to act on that authority, and it will be interesting to see how that process plays out. Getting some comments in this morning, I guess a question coming in saying, is T-gang enforcement a state or federal issue? Can Judge Jeanine Pirro prosecute DC teen crime, or where is the crime sent to juvenile court where they just get released so gangs put guns in teens' hands? Well, that's one of the major things that's being discussed right now is some of those authorities. And I will admit that that does remain kind of a gray area. And what one of the frustrating things, and this is nothing new, we've seen this literally since January 20th of this year, is when federal judges like Jeanine Pirro or somebody in her nature, and I know she hasn't been there since January 20th, her appointment is relatively recent, but when you've got individuals acting on authority in support of something that Donald Trump wants, you are seeing continued, and I will at this point argue, egregious lawsuits. Just over and over again, this consistent political lawfare over things being changed. And I'm not saying that there's no place for the courts in some of this. I'm not arguing that the court should just be null and void on this. Obviously, we live in a three-branch government system, and it's very important for those three branches to kind of be siloed and handle things their own manner. I'm not arguing that point at all. But what you are seeing is a strategy that is called and is named Sue Till Blue. When something is going on politically, and it's I note that politically, very importantly, something that's going on politically that you disagree with, like, for example, President Donald Trump using his authority over the Metropolitan Police Department, you see Democrats not trying to argue the merits of the issue, not trying to figure out a solution to the problem at hand, but you see consistent, overburdensome lawfare. They will just constantly take it to court. And this is an unfortunate strategy by those on the political left on things that are, in most cases, not in the purview of the court. But because our judicial system is so slow, because it is so overburdensome, because the wheels of justice turn so slowly, especially at the federal level, these things, many of these actions taken by a Republican administration or a Republican General Assembly, we've seen similar actions in North Carolina, some of these things can take years to go into place after the lawfare is all said and done. And by the time the lawfare is said and done and you're told by a judge, oh yeah, you were allowed to do this the whole time, you're out of power. You're no longer in office. Or the dynamics have changed so dramatically in a General Assembly or in Washington, D.C., that it's no longer relevant. And I'll give the Democrats credit where it's due. I don't agree with them. I don't support them. I don't support their policies. They have done a masterful job at using the legal system to block the agenda of opposition candidates and opposition administrations like you see right now. I will give the devil their due. They have done a masterful job at using the judicial system for that. I would argue and contend that's not the purpose of the judicial system. I think when we talk about three branches of government, I don't think the intention from our founding fathers was when something happens in one branch, you just use another to try and usurp that authority. I don't think that was the intention, but that's how the system is currently operating right now. Left-wing Democrat judges all across the United States trying to usurp their authority over the entire country. Fortunately, earlier this year, you did see some pushback on that. You did see some rulings that claimed that these federal district judges that are responsible for a relatively small geographic area, they do not have the authority to just say, oh yeah, throughout the entire U.S. now, you're not allowed to do this. Things have to be, for the most part, geographically bound to their area, because you had judges in California earlier this year, judges in Washington State earlier this year, ruling on Trump's immigration, claiming that the president was not allowed to handle immigration issues on the East Coast. There is no jurisdiction for a federal judge in Washington State to determine what is going on in a state like Virginia. I mean, there's absolutely no authority over that, but we saw Sutil Blue play out. It had to be slapped back. It had to be reined in a little bit, but it's something that the Trump administration continues to struggle with. So those are some of the big ticket issues. There's, of course, plenty of other things that will be discussed in the coming days and weeks. Government spending, obviously a big one. Tariffs has been in the news a lot over the last week or so with a ruling on that. We'll get into those details later this week. Plenty of other things. The Epstein files, I'm sure, will come back up for debate and discussion. A lot of that stuff as Congress is back in Washington this week. So we will keep an eye on all of that, keep an eye on all of those details. And as soon as we figure out exactly what is going on there, what the relevance is, and what things are looking like, we'll pass those details along to you right here on the Nick Craig Show. Also, something to keep on your radar today, President Donald Trump is making an announcement from the Oval Office at 2 p.m. That announcement, at least from rumors early this morning, is about the Department of Defense. Not exactly sure what that is going to look like, not exactly sure what that is going to be, but it is something with the Defense Department. Maybe it has to do with tariffs, maybe not. That will take place at 2 o'clock this afternoon. If the president says anything that is super newsworthy or has any major impact, of course, we'll keep an eye on those details and bring that information onto you, onto the show here as well. Well, this was a pretty shocking story. This came out late last night as I was rounding out last night, getting all the show prep ready to go. I saw this come across the wire. Representative Jerry Nadler, who is 78 years old, I'll show you a picture of him. You'll absolutely recognize him when I show you a picture of him, is set to not seek re-election as the one of the elder members of Congress have announced that he is not seeking re-election. Jerry Nadler making a lot of memes and a lot of social media chatter over the last couple of years having to do with his attire, his pants seemingly riding up all the way to his stomach. These are some of the pictures of Jerry Nadler that have drawn some interesting conversation on social media over the last couple of years. Him and his office announcing yesterday that he will not seek re-election in the House in the midterm elections next year, marking an end to his 34-year run representing the Midtown Manhattan area, a very prominent district in the United States, of course, right in the heart of the Big Apple in Congress. Nadler, who is 78 years old, cited a need for, quote, generational change, that's a direct quote, as a reason for calling it quits, and appears to suggest that watching former President Joe Biden's decline was a factor. The congressman told the New York Times this, quote, watching the Biden thing really said something about the necessity for generational change in the party, and I think I want to respect that. It's a pretty interesting statement there from Nadler, noting that a younger replacement can maybe do better and can maybe help us more. There is expected to be a massive vacuum for Nadler's seat, a pretty big deal in Midtown Manhattan, very prominent figure in Washington, D.C., as you are likely to see a plethora of candidates all push into this seat in Midtown Manhattan, which again has not been an open seat in 34 years. So that's going to be interesting to watch. And his commentary about, you know, handing the baton, I'm now paraphrasing what he told the New York Times, but for lack of a better term, handing over the baton to those on the younger side of the political spectrum, that is something that I think is probably well applauded across the country, but particularly when you look at what is going on the more progressive side of the political aisle. When you look at this major movement from those on the progressive left, these that are the Antifa, defund the police crowd, right? The Squad, the Rashida Tlaibs, the Ilhan Omars, the AOCs, who of course also is from New York, as those individuals, which this ideology tends to be more prominent amongst younger progressives. It's an interesting comment there from Jerry Nadler. Now, this is me reading in between the tea leaves. Is he pushing back on the status quo leadership of the Democrat Party? Pushing back against somebody like Chuck Schumer, who is also the Senate minority leader, also from the state of New York? Is he pushing back on the, what we'll call the old guard of the Democrat Party? Is he saying that what is being pushed by these folks doesn't make sense and we need to usher in the younger, more progressive movement? Or maybe he's not saying that. But his comment to the New York Times is one that definitely, as I was reading it last night, I was definitely scratching my head over. Because if, in fact, he is indicating that it is time for a more progressive movement, that, to me, would be a huge misstep for the Democrat Party currently. We are watching a mass rejection of crazy Democrat ideals. We are watching a mass rejection of the progressive movement. The soft-on-crime policies that you're watching unfold in cities across the country. You're watching this just out of control progressive movement that seemingly doesn't really have a whole hell of a lot of ideas, but is just running with all of these crazy policies all at the same time, not really honing in on one or two, but just kind of this blitzkrieg approach, right? Throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. This approach is not working. This approach is not popular, and I would argue it is being rejected by the vast majority of those in the United States. It is being rejected by a vast majority of those that are politically active. And, you know, for example, we'll talk about crime. For just this weekend in Chicago, one of the cities in which we were told there's no reason for federal authorities to step in. We were told by the progressive mayor in Brandon Johnson that there's no need for Trump to be singling out and targeting Chicago. Crime is not a problem. So as you would have come to expect on a holiday three-day weekend, there were 54 people shot, 7 people murdered in Chicago over the weekend. Right? These are the progressive ideas that are being rejected. These are the nonsensical political arguments that are being made by those on the left that are just not working. 54 people shot in Chicago over the weekend. 7 people shot and killed to ring in the new month of September. You're telling me this is a win? President Donald Trump just commented on this like just minutes ago on Truth Social, saying this: at least 54 people were shot in Chicago over the weekend. 8 people were killed. The last 2 weekends were similar. Chicago is the worst and most dangerous city in the world by far. Pritzker, talking about the governor, needs help badly. He just doesn't know it yet. I will solve the crime problem fast, just like I did in D.C. Chicago will be safe again and soon make America great again. This comment coming in just minutes ago from President Donald Trump as he continues to ratchet up his pressure over crime in major Democrat cities. And he's absolutely spot on about it. This is an 80-20 winning issue for those on the GOP side, on the Republican, on the conservative side that understand that weak on crime policies, like in places like Chicago, like New York, like DC, like LA and Philadelphia and St. Louis and so on and so forth, all of these major blue Democrat cities, does not work. And so all of this ties into the comments from Jerry Nadler in his announcement that he is retiring. Is he ushering in individuals or trying to encourage and usher in individuals that have these same ideals, that are even more radical on things like crime, that are even more anti-police, more pro-criminal? Because if that's what he is ushering in, he is dooming the Democrat Party. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't guarantee anything as it relates to elections. Anybody that says they can guarantee what's going to happen in an election is purposefully lying to you because they have absolutely no clue. Elections are so unique and so dynamic. But as we sit here heading into the month of September, it looks to me that if the Democrat Party does not get their act together very quickly, and I mean very quickly, midterm elections are a little over a year away. If they do not get their act together very quickly, they are going to face a significant hurdle as we head into the midterm elections. Democrats should do well next year. Midterm elections always, historically, have favored the party that is not in power. That would be the Democrats right now. This is a historical norm going back 100 plus years. The party that is not in power, the opposition party, always does better in midterm elections. As it stands right now, as the polling stands right now, and as the national attention stands right now, things do not look very good for those on the left. And part of the reason why is being on the losing side of these 80-20 issues like crime. You've got a radical progressive mayor in Brandon Jones in Chicago that is making the argument, is making the point that crime is not a problem in his city, pushing back against what Donald Trump is saying. Meanwhile, 54 people were shot in his city over the 3-day weekend. And he's going to stand up on the national stage. He is going to jump in front of cameras and microphones and claim that there is no problem here. The only way you can describe that is complete and total insanity. There is not a single person in the country that actually believes that 54 people being shot over a three-day span period of time is not an issue. And anybody that says they don't think that's an issue is just a hyper-partisan. They are only saying that because they don't like what Donald Trump is threatening and they want to support the progressive cause. Any rational, sane, normal person would tell you 54 people being shot over Labor Day weekend is a bad thing and needs to be fixed. 54 people, 7, maybe 8, being killed. Those are not good numbers for those that are cheering this on and are running with the banner on the progressive left. Right? This does not fit their narrative, does not fit their agenda well at all. And so, with Nadler retiring, talking about passing the baton to a younger generation, it's going to be interesting to see. You're already seeing in New York City with Zohran Mamdani, this more progressive radical wing trying to take over the Democrat Party. The question is this isolated to hyper blue areas and states like New York, or does some of that start trickling out to other states across the country? If it does, I think the Democrats are doomed because these ideas are not popular. They might be in the echo chamber. If you're a radical progressive in New York City, you might think this is the greatest stuff you've ever heard. But when you poll the vast majority of Americans, even those that are on the Democrat side of the aisle, they don't like this stuff. They don't like the soft on crime. They don't like the anti-police. They don't like the Antifa movement. They don't like protesters blocking major highways at rush hours, screaming about Palestine. They're not in support of this stuff. It's incredibly radical, and it's only popular amongst a very, what I'll call small, but vocal subset of those on the Democrat side of the aisle. So a lot to deconstruct with this. With Nadler announcing he's out, the vacuum is going to now exist in that Manhattan district. It's going to be interesting to see who jumps into that race and who takes control of that. I'm sure Zohran Mamdani will have some part to play in that. Yes, he's got his race later this year, but it's going to be interesting to see if he backs a more progressive wing candidate and kind of propels them through the primary, which will take place in March of next year, and then, of course, onto a general election coming up in November of 2026. We'll keep an eye on all of those details. I want to remind you that if you are interested in getting access to daily show notes and more, you can head on over to patreon.com/Nick Craig. We have a monthly hangout. We had that last week. A great hangout as always. $5, $10 a month. You can also set a custom amount if you believe that you are getting some value from the show each and every weekday morning. patreon.com/Nick Craig. We've got a great group of folks supporting over on Patreon. I can't thank them enough for giving me and allowing me the opportunity to do this show each and every weekday morning with their financial contributions and support. patreon.com/Nick Craig. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is going to do it for a Tuesday edition of the Nick Craig Show. We'll watch President Trump's announcement 2:00 this afternoon and see if we get any new details out of Congress. We'll have those details coming up for you tomorrow morning. Thanks to the Law Group here in Wilmington for their continued support. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. The Nick Craig Show live weekday morning, 7 a.m. YouTube, Rumble, X, Facebook, and 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great Tuesday.